I know that things are becoming more and more difficult. And I know I started out my sermon last week saying the same thing. It sounds familiar because we are focusing on all of the things that are happening in the world. And they are happening on a very quick scale today. We know that the economy is affected, and many people say, oh, we're going to pull out of it, or depending on who gets into political office, we'll pull out of it. But the economy is in very poor condition, and in some ways, all of the effects of not just the economy, but the economy, morality, the world conditions, and what's taking place in other parts of the world, often those begin to affect the church. And I mentioned recently how persecution is one of the things that Christ said when they ask him, what is the sign of the end? What's the sign of the end of the age? And he said there's going to be persecution. And I think we're beginning to see how that is going to take place and what will take place. But Christ warned it would come at the end of the age. I was looking for a hall this week. I mentioned last week that we were still in that process, and I had an appointment this week. I met with a realtor, showed me a building, and he said this has been sitting empty since COVID began. So he said, I'm going on 3 years now. He said there was some water damage, and he said the landlord hasn't fixed it. And of course, ceiling tiles were laying on the floor back in a couple of rooms. But he says he doesn't want to put a lot of money into it. And he said, although it is zoned for having meetings or assembling, he goes, just to be honest, you probably will have a very difficult time trying to get through the city to get this. He said, the city, he goes, I know you're a pastor. He said, I'm Catholic. And he said, we're all Christian. And he says that the local politicians, as well as state politicians, are becoming very, very difficult to deal with, and they do not want religious assemblies in the cities. And so he said, is it going to be very difficult? He said, there are a few cities, and he mentioned those to me, that are easier to deal with. But he said, the city that I was looking at, and he said, Pasadena and a couple others, he said, you're almost not likely to find a place that you can rent because of individuals not wanting Christians and not wanting religion, period. He said, it doesn't matter what kind of religion, they just don't want religious assemblies. And it was very helpful. And he says, if anything comes up, I'll get a hold of you and let you know. But he said, I'm just telling you that. And I said, well, you're not the first realtor that has told me that. That is something that we see. But it's persecution against religion. There's a writing that caught my eye years ago, and I have kept it, but I think it really captures the time that we live in. By Thomas Paine, December 23rd, 1776, and it's entitled Stand Strong, My Brothers. Now, December 23rd, 1776, Thomas Paine's writing, The American Crisis, was read to the Continental Army as it prepared to attack the Hessians in Trenton. So this was preparing to go to battle, preparing to go to war, and Thomas Paine had this particular writing, and the part that I want to read to you is Stand Strong, My Brothers. He says, these are times that try men's souls. The summer soldier and sunshine patriot will in crisis shrink from the service of their country. That summer soldier, he said, the part-timer, the individual who's only partially invested, they will in crisis shrink from the service of their country, but he that stands by it now deserves the love and thanks of man and woman. Tyranny, like hell, is not easily conquered. Yet we have a consolation with us that the harder the conflict, the more glorious the triumph. What we obtain too cheap, we esteem too lightly. And in its dearness is the only thing that gives us true value. Sometimes the hardest trials give us the greater blessings when we go through them. Now, at the time, I most of you would probably agree with me, as we're going through a difficult trial, we don't say, I'm learning so much, and this is the greatest thing that's happened to me. But it does bring greater blessings when we go through difficult trials. And often the difficult trials bring us to a higher position than if we say, we have no trials at all, I have no problems, I've got no difficulties I'm going through. They do develop us, and they do help us. And in war, as inferred to in this writing, it's always a trying time. But there are other things that can be equally as troubling as war. We live in a society, and it's becoming more and more difficult, but we are in a spiritual battle. And it is a spiritual war that we're fighting, and Satan and his army are very, very active. Society led by Satan is also against what we believe or what we should believe. And like something so simple as finding a hall, you wouldn't think religion would be involved. I've been in places over the years looking for halls, and they said, sounds like a great group. We'd love to have you. Can I see your fundamental doctrines? Sure. And they said, oh, no, we cannot let you meet here. You don't believe in the Trinity. Just instantly, you don't believe like we do. We can't have anything to do with you. Now, Christ warned that if they hated him, they would hate us also. If they hated his word, they will hate your word also. We live in a world that is screaming not to persecute others, not to persecute their beliefs, not to persecute their choices, not to persecute them when they're gender confused and they don't know which gender they are. But if you're a Christian and you have convictions and you have principles that you stand by, those same rules don't apply. Now, Christians are the persecutors. You have to accept our beliefs, our ideas, our idea of the way the world is and the way the world should be, but we cannot accept you as a Christian. The Bible and Christianity are now considered hate speech. In other parts of the world, even more so than the United States, but it is coming. They say the Bible is hate speech because it condemns homosexuality, because it condemns lifestyles outside of marriage, because it condemns human beings for particular sins. And again, it is considered now hate speech and referenced that way even in courts of law. How much worse is it going to get? Quite frankly, the hearts of men are being tried. The hearts of Christians and those that God has called are being tried. Tried on the commitment and the dedication to our beliefs. How dedicated are we? How committed are we to living this way of life and staying faithful to this way of life? Tried on faith and entrusting in God. In so many things that have come up even in the last few years, do I trust God or do I make my own judgment or my own decision? Tried on keeping the Sabbath or assembling as a Sabbath as we're commanded to do. Now, it's not uncommon that God tries those he's working with. He says, to those whom I love, I chasten, I correct. Let's go to Psalm chapter 17 and verse 3. Psalm chapter 17 and verse 3. He says, you have tested my heart. You have visited me in the night and you have tried me. Now, God does try us. He tries each of us individually, and he tries us as a group of his people. But he says, you have tried me, you have found nothing. I have purposed that my mouth shall not transgress concerning the works of men, but the word of your lips I have kept away from the path of the destroyer. The psalmist even asked to be tried. Now, I think most of us have had a fair share of difficulties and trials. But have you ever asked God to try you? It's a little bit more. Let's go to Psalm 139, verse 23. Psalm 139, verse 23. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me, and know my thoughts. Asking God to try us, asking God to think about our thoughts, to know our thoughts, can be a scary thing, and many of us may feel, well, I've tried enough without asking for more. I feel like I'm tried. I feel like I'm going through trials and difficulties. I don't think I need more on my plate, but that's why we ask God to do what he does in mercy. But asking him to try us, asking him to know our thoughts, because we want them to be in the right place. And some don't like to ask because they want to avoid certain things. Well, if I ask God, God's going to know my thoughts. Well, God knows your thoughts already. When we ask God, know my thoughts, as was written here in the psalm, he's asking God to reveal to him what needs to be done or anything that is in flaw. Are we guilty of not asking because we don't want to know? Being tried through trials and tribulations can be rewarding, and it can be very successful. If we are doing what we should, and if we are committed and we're not falling asleep. I don't mean falling asleep in services. If you do that, I can probably slap the lectern or do something as I used to do years ago. I've even seen pastors call people out when they're falling asleep. This is many years ago, but I won't do that. I'm talking about spiritually falling asleep or becoming spiritually lethargic. But it is possible, if we're not careful, to fall asleep. But if we're doing what we can, and if we're doing what we should, and we're mentally and spiritually alert, then it can be very, very rewarding in this life, but even more so in the life to come. We find something similar in Romans chapter 5. Romans chapter 5 and verse 3. Romans 5 and verse 3. He says, not only so, but we glory in tribulation. Glory in tribulation. Knowing that tribulation works patience. Patience, experience, and experience, hope. He said, there are things when you go through trials and difficulties, we can glory because as the poem or as the writing by Mr. Payne, when we go through those difficulties that are much more difficult, when we go through the serious difficulties of life or heavy difficulties, they can be extremely rewarding. And God says here that we glory in our tribulation. And there's a lot of people who say, I don't want to glory in tribulation. And even when I get through a trial, I don't even want to think about it. I don't want to know anything about it. I just want to be moved on with no trials and no difficulties. But we're missing something because he said, knowing that those trials and tribulations work patience, patience works experience, and experience hope. And if we can gain patience, experience, and hope, then it is something that is beneficial to us now, and it's going to motivate us to become more. One thing leads to the next, but we have to be doing it. Now, when it says we glory in tribulation, the word glory here is to boast or to make glad. We make glad in our tribulation. Because when we're going through a difficult trial, we can almost guarantee we're going to learn something from it. And so we can make glad in our trial and tribulation going, there's something I need to learn. Knowing that it is going to be for good. Knowing that we have hopefully learned something from those trials and tribulations because they do work in us. Patience, experience, and hope. When we finish a trial or testing, do we look back to glean what we can from it? I've been through some very serious trials in my life, difficulties, deaths in the family, my dad dying when I was very young, been through financial troubles and issues. I've owned my own businesses before. I've been in the business world, but have gone through trials that after I came out of them, yes, I rejoiced then, but I rejoice now so much more looking at those trials and what I had to go through and what I learned from them. And that's what he's saying here. We can make glad in our tribulation knowing that it's going to work for good. But looking back at those and saying, what can I glean from that trial, especially coming fresh out of a trial or difficulty? What is it that I can learn? What is it that I can develop? Do we try to see what we can learn from it? Or do we just think, well, I'm glad it's over, and we move on? I've had a lot of people say, I don't even want to think about the trial. It was so bad, so difficult, it's out of my mind. But what can you learn from it, and what can you glean from it? Sometimes we don't understand the why of things and why they're happening, especially at the time. And many people just try to avoid having any difficulties. Just watching a movie recently, and there was an individual who had tried to create a society where nobody could remember any of the difficulties or trials they'd ever had in their life. We don't want people to remember the bad things, and so they were wiping their minds of all the bad history. Well, then you have people that can easily repeat doing things that they did in the past that created that bad history. But again, it's not a matter of wanting to have no trials and no difficulty. We don't pray for them. We don't ask God to give me difficulty, but we do ask God to try us, to look at our minds, to look at our hearts. Nearly every time we go through a trial, there is something that we can learn from it. And humans have a tendency to think, well, life would be easier if there's no trials, there's no hard times, no difficulties. And God does promise a time like that. But that's not the life we live in right now. Ann Bradstreet says, if we had no winter, the spring would not be so pleasant. Now I'm speaking to Californians, and winter, oh, it's horrible. It's 60 degrees today, and last night got down to almost 40 degrees. That's California winter. But in other parts of the country, if you were in Buffalo, New York today, where Buffalo is getting not inches of snow, they're getting feet of snow, lake effect snow that is actually burying the city. They closed schools yesterday, and they have closed schools for the beginning of the week just because of the amount of snow. But Ann Bradstreet says, if we had no winter, spring would not be so pleasant. If we did not sometimes taste adversity, prosperity would not be so welcome. I mentioned going through difficult times, even financial difficult times. And I'm glad I went through that before God began to bless me financially to the point in another job, another position years later. And I valued and appreciated that because I knew what it was like to go through a difficulty financially. And again, God will take us through those things so that we learn something from it. Or like Thomas Paine said, the harder the conflict, the more glorious the triumph. When you have a struggle and a difficulty that is so hard and you're fighting through it, when you finally get to the point of, okay, I can breathe again, he said there is a triumph that we overcame. We made it through the trial. He says we can obtain what we obtain too cheap or esteem too lightly. He said if we obtain it just easily, and that's why most of us, I think, as parents, when our kids are growing up, they're like, I want this, I want that. No? Okay. You want that? Work for it. Because if they work for it, they appreciate it more. I love seeing that as a parent, especially with my middle child. She wanted a job, so she went out and created a job, actually talked a company into hiring her. And she said, I'm going to be making so much money for her. It was. And she said, I'm going to buy this, I'm going to buy this, I'm going to buy this. And she got her paycheck and she goes, that stuff's expensive. She goes, you know how many hours I would have to work to pay for that shirt or that pair of pants or those clothing? And she goes, I'm not going to do that. That's hard work. And so she realized, I was like, she learned a good lesson. Very valuable. But when you work and something is difficult, you appreciate it more. There's a value to it. And it says, Thomas Paine said, its dearness only gives us it the true value. How much we value it, how much we realize how precious it is. And again, that has spiritual consequences as well. The difficulties and the testing that we have been through make us who we are. You know, people say, well, if you could go back in time, if you could start over at 20, if you could start over at 15, would you do it? It's like, if I had, can I retain all the lessons I've learned now, or do I have to go back to being that naive 15-year-old? There's so many things I would miss if I had to give up those lessons and valuable things that I've learned. But those trials and testings, they make us who we are, and we should appreciate that. And we who are here are still fighting, still going through difficulties. When we look back at our lives, especially the difficult times, we can appreciate those so much more. Thinking about the value of God's calling, the value of understanding the plan of God, having that revealed to us, having God open our minds with His Holy Spirit to be able to understand things scripturally, having the understanding of His kingdom and His government and what is ahead. The Apostle Paul reminds us of a certain perspective that we need. We're already in Romans. Let's go to Romans chapter 8 and verse 18. Romans 8 and verse 18. Now, we can look at the life of the Apostle Paul and realize he suffered a great deal. He caused suffering a great deal, but he also suffered himself a great deal, being stoned, snake bit, shipwrecked, all the different things that he was persecuted with. But he says, I reckon that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that shall be revealed in us. He says, the things that we go through in this lifetime cannot be compared to the glory. I've often used this when counseling individuals for baptism about counting the cost. Looking forward and saying, okay, not just now, is there anything right now that would draw you away or keep you from fulfilling your commitment to God? But not just now, but when you look down the line and in the future. Counting the cost, looking ahead. But the sufferings of this time are not worthy to be compared. And so I tell individuals, you're going to have times of trials and times of difficulty, and when you receive the Spirit of God, Satan is going to attack in every way that he can. The world is deceived, and he will continue to deceive the world, but they're already deceived. He wants to deceive those who have the Spirit and draw them away from God. Is a lost job or car problems or being sick for a period of time something that you can begin to compare to what God is doing? Now, I've seen individuals go through multiples like this. Loss in the family, being sick, car problems, lost a job. And they think, well, everything is just so overwhelming. Is it all worth it? Well, when you compare that to what Paul is talking about here, compared with the glory that's going to be revealed in us. Okay, we have eternal life as a spirit being. No more tears, no more pain, no more sorrow. Is having a flat tire and losing a job, or is getting sick, or even all of those at one time, even comparable to being given the glory of God and being made of spirit, composed of spirit? It does not compare with what God is doing. And when we fully understand God's plan, even losing a loved one or even losing our own life cannot compare. If we say, well, you know, looking to the future and counting the cost, if you had to lose your life for standing up for God's way of life, is that something that you feel that you could do? Cannot compare to, well, no, I don't know if I could give up my life or stand up to that point that if somebody was going to kill me if I renounce God, then I don't know if I could do that. We have to be the point where we say, no, there's so much that cannot even compare to what God has promised to us and what God has already given to us. And God has a plan. He has a resurrection. He has a better future. And if we believe that and are committed to that and understand that, then it should be nothing that draws us away, especially those he has called. Yet today, many people suffer through some pretty severe trials. When we talk to each other and we share our trials with one another, the prayer requests that come out, and there are trials that sometimes people don't share with all the members, but share with one another individually as need be. But we know that there are severe trials that individuals go through, and sometimes we realize, especially now, it's going to be harder. It's almost certain to be harder. We are approaching the Great Tribulation, and I think many people see that. Even individuals who are not in the church and they're part of politics in other parts of the world, or they're reporters in other parts of the world, they see the handwriting on the wall and they say, we see we are approaching a major international and global catastrophe or global war, and they see these things taking place. Matthew 24, verse 21 says, for then will be great tribulation such as not been since the beginning of the world, until this time, no, nor ever shall be. A time is coming that is said has not been since the beginning of the world. So God says, there's a trial and a difficulty that's ahead, something that you have to consider in the future, and it's difficult, more difficult than anything that has happened before. We are on the brink of what will be the most difficult time in human history. And yet I think far too many take it for granted. It continues, unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. He said it's going to get to the point where man would annihilate himself from the face of the earth. But God's not going to allow that. These are the times that are trying our souls. And the times that are ahead will try them in a way that man has not seen before. It is going to get worse. And we're living through some very difficult challenges, even within the church. When we look at the last 10, 20, 30 years, there have been splits over doctrine. There have been splits over integrity or behavior, which is still doctrinal, still includes doctrine. We've seen people walk away from religion as a whole, and for some very petty things. And what Paul says is nothing can compare to the glory, yet people say, yeah, but there's something right here in the here and now that I want and I don't want to give up. And we've seen people walk away from truth and from knowledge and from the future glory that God has promised and with things that do not compare. But we know it's going to get worse, far worse than what we're in now. Even the realtor that I was talking to this week, he said, I know times are very difficult, but he said, there's so much more coming on this world. He said, the times are gone. He said, things don't look like it's going to change soon, and things are going to get a lot worse. Here's an individual who hasn't had his eyes open to the truth yet, but can still see that. I want to go through several tools that will help us see us through the difficulties and trials, especially those that are ahead. As I began to put this sermon together, I realized I had far too much information and I'm not going to be able to complete it in one sermon, so I'm actually going to do it in two parts. And it kept expanding, and I was like, well, I don't want to cut that out, and okay, now it's too far. I'm going to have to do it in two different messages. There's not many messages that I separate like that and finish in a second part, but there are some. It's worth going through and spending the time on each of these in detail. But I'm going to go through and look at what we need to survive the times that try men's souls. First, we need discernment. And discernment is vital. Discernment, according to the Free Dictionary, can be defined as the act or process of exhibiting keen insight and good judgment. So discernment is keen insight and good judgment. And the definition actually helps us a great deal because it explains it's not just something that happens in an instant or something that we just, oh, I need discernment. Okay, then I'll just look something up or I'll get some information and now I've got discernment. It's not something that happens instantly. The definition here says the act or process. And it is a process. It's something that is learned. And the ability to discern is something that is learned and something that we develop. It's a process that's honed and developed over time, and it's through experience. And usually those with better discernment and a better keen eyesight into things or through things are those who have been through trials and difficulties and have learned some lessons. There's two ways of learning lessons and two ways of approaching trials and difficulties. Going through them ourselves, which is, although hard to do and difficult, we learn a great value. We can also learn by others going through difficulties and others going through mistakes. There's a lot of things that happened when I was young. My sister said, I'll learn by my own mistakes. And I said, that's not a good choice. And as she made mistakes, I learned from her mistakes. I was like, okay, I don't want to do that. Nope, don't do that. But we don't learn from, and we don't say, well, I'm going to learn from my own mistakes by making my own choices. You can, and we do. We all have to go through some of those things. But we can learn from the mistakes of others and the difficulties of others. And especially in the church, when we share the difficulties and go through trials with others or help another individual through a trial, we learn through experience. And some of that experience often is through the trials or testing of other people. And Carter Dictionary says that discernment is the ability to make good judgments. And again, and Carter Dictionary is a little bit more simple, the ability to make good judgments. But to make good judgments, we have to see things clearly. What happens when a person cannot see things clearly? We've been having some horrible winds in Fontana. We had, in this past week, the winds started on Sunday. They went through Wednesday. But five big rigs blew over. Our trees are now stripped to little twigs in the back. Our banana trees and some of the other trees, broken limbs on palm trees. A lot of trees were downed. But there's a lot of wind that we've had to suffer. 70 to 80 mile an hour wind in Fontana. That's hurricane force. And when it blows barbecues over, we had a terracotta pot, big terracotta pot full of dirt, and it blew the terracotta pot over and rolled it. That's pretty hefty wind. I want to read from Today in the Word. This is from 1992. It said, on November 30th, 1991, fierce winds from a freakish dust storm triggered a massive freeway pileup along Interstate 5 in Coalinga, California. Now, some of you are from Fresno. You know where Coalinga is. Others have traveled up and down the 5 or the 99. But at least 14 people died and dozens were injured as topsoil, whipped by 50-mile-an-hour winds, reduced visibility to zero. The afternoon holocaust left a three-mile trail of twisted and burning vehicles, some stacked on top of one another, 100 yards off the road or off the freeway. Unable to see their way, dozens of motorists drove blindly ahead into disaster. They couldn't see, but they just kept driving through it until they piled up and lives were lost. There's some valuable lessons to learn from that. And again, this is one of those situations where you learn from a difficulty or trial of another individual. People can become very unaware or blinded, and when they can't see things clearly, when they cannot see things as they are or see through situations, it can become very dangerous. But people, the worst part is not knowing how to react, not knowing what to do. And some people, when they see a dust storm like that or they lose visibility, let's just drive as fast as we can and get out of it. A very dangerous thing to do. More of you are probably familiar with the Thule fog. I lived in Visalia for almost 4 years, right along the 99. They call it the Thule fog. This is from the National Weather Service. This is one of the most dangerous aspects of the rainy season through San Joaquin Valley is the Thule fog. It forms on clear nights, and you think, forms on a clear night. Forms on clear nights when the ground is moist and the wind is near calm. On nights like this, the ground cools rapidly, and in turn, moist air above it cools and causes the vapor to condense. Once it has formed, the air must be heated enough to either evaporate the fog or lift it above the surface so that visibility improves. The visibility in Thule fog is often less than 1/8 of a mile, or about 600 feet, but can be less than 10 feet. I have driven on the 99, and when I say the Thule fog, it's very odd. We lived about 2.5 miles or 3 miles off the interstate. And it was bright and sunny, but you get over to the freeway and the Thule fog is just sitting on the 99. It's a very odd thing to watch. But I have seen it and driven to church in Central Valley where you can see one car length in front of you. That is it. And people are going 5 miles an hour or traffic coming to a stop. I've actually seen in avoided situations where there were 50 car pileups because people just kept driving into the fog. So it says there's less than 10 feet, and sometimes visibility can vary rapidly in an area with sudden decreases to near zero or only a few feet. It is a serious situation like this that often leads to multi-car accidents where one follows another into a fog bank. Then they've had even up to 100 cars wrecking in fog. One person simply following the one in front of him. Oh, I can still see headlights. Let's just keep going through the fog at a high rate of speed. The dangers are still there, even though people can't see them. We were heading to church one day, and traffic was backing up, and the fog was so bad. And so I got off, and I found out there was an accident ahead of us. And when I say an accident, 50 cars had piled up, and there was all kinds of shut down on the interstate, and so we were able to get off. And then once we got off, we had to wait on a train. We were 50 minutes late to services, but we took a back road, and once we got off the freeway and the interstate, we got out of the fog and actually were able to take side roads. But it's interesting seeing how individuals react, because the dangers are still there. They just can't see them. And dangers are there around us spiritually as well. And sometimes people can't see those dangers, and so they blindly just keep going the way they've been doing things and thinking, I'm fine. I've had these dangers before. I've seen the fog before. And spiritually can make mistakes. So we have to look and we have to discern. One thing that I learned years ago is that people actually accelerate when they go into a blanket of fog. And you think, why would they accelerate? It's not because they just a few bricks shy of a load. It's a natural tendency that people have. They move forward, but they can't see the surroundings. When you're driving, even if you're driving across Arizona or New Mexico, where the scenery doesn't change, you at least see things going by, and you can see things in the distance. You have a perception of where you are. But when you're moving and you can't see things or can't see surroundings going by, people will accelerate because they can't see anything, and so they just, it's a natural tendency to push on that gas pedal. Have you ever put yourself in a dangerous position because you couldn't see clearly? I don't know what decision to make, but you just keep moving forward without taking that time to say, wait a minute, I need to back off. I need to consider what's around me. Have you ever been in a situation spiritually where things were not clear? I think most of us here have been in that situation through 1995 and all the things that took place. There was a heavy spiritual fog over the church, and some could discern it quickly. And we're able to identify very quickly, this is not good. I need to back up and take a look at the situation, where others put on the gas pedal or just kept moving. Many, including some loved ones of mine, did not have the ability to see things clearly and went right into the fog. We have to act accordingly, even when things are not so clear. Action is something that we can't avoid, but what is the action we take? This is where discernment comes into play. Now, physically speaking, we slow down, we observe with the eyes, we consider everything around us. Some people just follow the yellow line because the lights can hit that, and they watch for red lights ahead of them, brake lights. But that's in a physical situation, and even then, it's still dangerous. It's almost easier to do than something spiritual, because spiritually speaking, when we come into a spiritual situation, sometimes it's not so clear because it's a spiritual situation. But we still need to slow down. Now, there are yellow lines. When you're looking at the yellow line, you're looking at, okay, what is it that keeps me on the interstate and going in the direction that I need to go? Well, spiritually speaking, there is yellow lines. God lays down His law, His way of life, and says, you have to stay within that. And as long as you stay within that path and you're cautious, you can continue to move forward. But we have to heed the warning signs and we have to be cautious. We have to pray that God will guide us. Now, I even prayed that when I was going through the Thule fog, that God would guide us, at least until we get to the next exit. But we have to ask God to guide us where we can't see clearly, because we have to have understanding. And we can't move forward without an understanding, without a depth of knowledge where we can make choices. Because if discernment is the ability to make wise choices, you have to make those choices based on what you know, the understanding. And spiritual discernment goes beyond just simply making good judgments. It's the ability to see through something. The ability to hear something and look at it in a situation to say, okay, I see what you're saying, but what is the reason, or what is the why? What goes beyond that? What are the results of this? To see through a matter, to see through a situation. And I think most of us have probably been in situations where somebody's telling us and you're going, okay, I think I see what's happening, but I'm only hearing one perspective. And is that really the way it happened? Because when you talk to multiple individuals, each has a perspective of what took place. But to look at a situation or trial and to be able to understand what it is really about. And when we see that we don't have all of the facts, and oftentimes that's common, we have to search them out. Proverbs chapter 25 and verse 2. Proverbs chapter 25 and verse 2. It is the glory of God to conceal a thing, not to just to spout out everything that we know or everything that we've seen or heard. It's glory of God to conceal a thing, and we don't want to gossip. But it's the honor of kings to search out a matter. He said, you know, sometimes you conceal things or you conceal how you feel about things until you've gotten further information to search out a matter. Search out here is a phrase according to Strong's Concordance that means to examine immediately. He said we search out a matter. We examine a matter immediately. We don't jump to conclusions. We say, no, I need to examine and I need to see what is actually taking place. Once we have searched out a matter, then we can use discernment, which is the ability to make good judgments. You search out a matter, you get the information, you get all the facts, and you go, now I can make good judgments, which is discernment. The ability then to make choices in which direction you're going to go. I want to read from statistics and stuff. This is Jay Stowell from 1986. Discernment in Scripture is a skill that enables us to differentiate, to be able to step back and have a perspective of different things. It is the ability to see issues clearly. We desperately need to cultivate this spiritual skill that will enable us to know right from wrong. Now, I'm glad they mentioned this because there's a way of looking at this. We must be prepared to distinguish light from darkness, truth from error, best from better, righteousness from unrighteousness, purity from defilement, and principles from pragmatics. One definition that I have shared with you before, and I think it's a good definition of discernment, is the ability to distinguish between what is right and what is almost right. Because people say, well, you know, these people, they're almost Christian. They've got all of these good things about them. They're doing these wonderful things. Well, do they have an understanding of the truth? Do they have God's Spirit? No, but they're almost right. Well, there's a lot of good people in the world. Most of us have relatives or grandparents that we just adore, and we go, they're not bad people. But if you're comparing that to, well, now these are God's people, these are called individuals, these are individuals who have their eyes opened, it's different. So be able to distinguish what is right and what's almost right. In the past, people have said, well, they keep the Sabbath and the holy days. So did the Jews. And the Jews said, crucify him. We can't say, well, they almost had it right. Discernment is the ability to see through a situation and to be able to identify, is it right or is it almost right? And if it's not completely right, what is it that's missing? And is it, well, you know, it's only 5% of it is, 5% of what this individual does is bad. Okay, so if you had something that was only 5% arsenic, it's not going to be that bad for you because it's 95% good. It's almost right. No, we consider something like that. You go, oh, well, no, that would never do that. Spiritually, we can't either, and we have to be able to distinguish, is that right or is it almost right? And that's a good definition of discernment. Discernment is something that's needed now more than ever. And so what is your discernment like? Have you asked God to help you develop, as it said, the process of discernment? I've had people tell me in the past, I just want to be told what to do. I just want to be told from the church what I need to do. I don't want to have to think about it. Now, many of those who had that frame of mind are gone because the church told them to do certain things, and they say, well, that's on the church. It's not on me. I just want to be told what to do. And when the time came, many didn't have to think about it. They just accepted blindly, and they followed, and they put on the accelerator. We have to think about it. We have to have a certain kind of discernment that only comes from God. And we have to consider matters that, spiritually speaking, when we do the discernment, we know ourselves what to do. Excuse me. We have to go through life not depending on somebody else to make the decisions for us, but we have to know ourselves and understand ourselves internally, but also know ourselves what we need to do for the future. Philippians chapter 2 and verse 12. Philippians chapter 2 and verse 12. Wherefore, my brethren, as you have always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but much more in my absence. He says, you've obeyed, and some people obey, well, we got somebody coming. We have to be on our best behavior. He said, you behaved not just when I was there, but also in my absence. That's when it depends on you. And most of us can relate to that. When we send our kids out, we don't tell them, you better behave when I'm around you. No, we say, you better behave when you're not with me. That's what Paul was saying here. But he says, work out or accomplish your own salvation with fear and trembling. He doesn't say follow somebody blindly. He doesn't say have somebody do it for you or tell you what it is. He says, work out your own salvation. For it is God which works in you both to will, the desire, and to do of his good pleasure. Do all things without murmuring and disputing, that you may be blameless and harmless, the sons of God, without rebuke, in the midst of a crooked and perverse nation, among whom you shine as lights in the world. Now that was written here in Philippians, but it could be very easily given to us today. You shine as lights in a crooked and perverse nation. Yeah, we live in a crooked and perverse world. And we see that we can still live our lives in a way that we should, even though the world is declining morally, the world is declining in the ability to have a relationship with God, but we live in a world where we can still stand out. And we sometimes need to be slow to make judgments, slow to do things because of the way the world will react, but we still live that way of life. We have to search things out. Proverbs 18 says, he that answers a matter before he hears it is a folly and a shame to him. If somebody is addressing you with something and you don't have all the facts, it's not a time to jump out and just answer the matter. It's easier to say, you know what, I'd like to talk with you about this more. I'll get back with you. I need to do a little bit of research. Far too many jump into battles without knowing what it's even about, and especially today because there's fake news. People will hear something on the news and run with it. This is what's taking place in the world, where if you flipped a channel, you'd hear the opposite. No, this is what's taking place. Sometimes you have to get the more information. But to be able to judge a matter justly, a person has to get all the information. That has to do in your relationships with others. It has to do in understanding of what's going on in the world. We have to search out the answers, and we have to find truth. When we look at truth, there's a passage in Acts that's only referred to on occasion. It's not something that's turned to quite frequently, but it's about the Bereans. Acts chapter 17. Acts 17, verse 10. It says, and the brethren immediately sent Paul and Silas by night into Berea, who, coming there, went into the synagogue of the Jews. Verse 11 says that these, the Bereans, were more noble than those in Thessalonica. Now, we read from Thessalonians. These were more noble than those in Thessalonica, in that they received the word with readiness of mind, meaning they were humble, they were teachable, just like we talked about in the blessing of the children. Being humble and teachable, you have to become like a child. They were humble and they were teachable, but they weren't pushovers and they weren't just following whoever and whenever. It says they searched the scriptures daily whether those things were so. Noble here is a word that means well, fulfilled, or sound. So the Bereans were more sound than those in Thessalonica. And it tells us why, because they searched the scriptures daily. They proved whether something was true or not. They didn't just accept it or accept what they were told to believe, they proved it. In the trials and stresses that are on us now and the ones that will come in the not-so-distant future, and I say not-so-distant because we're already seeing those things and they are expanding, Will we prove what is right? If we want to come through a trial or difficulty, we have to make wise choices, and to do that, we have to prove things. Let's go to Thessalonians, and I want to look at a list of things to help us through difficult end times. Now, we just read about the Bereans who were more noble than the Thessalonians, or those in Thessalonica. Now we're going to read even those in Thessalonians. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, and in verse 1. 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 1. But of the times and season, brethren, you have no need that I write to you. Much like I've started off the last 2 weeks' messages, we live in difficult times. And I could have said, there's no need for me to tell you we live in difficult times if you go shopping. Now, shopping, people say, oh, the news. Thanksgiving meal is going to cost you 20% more than it did last year. When you're going, okay, Thanksgiving meal, even if I spent $100, so now it's going to cost $120. But it's not just the Thanksgiving meal. We see that everything has gone up. And I know that financially things are difficult. So here it says, of the times and seasons, I have no need to write to you, for you yourselves know perfectly that the day of the Lord so comes as a thief in the night. For when they shall say, peace and safety, then sudden destruction comes upon them as a travailing woman with child, and they shall not escape. But you, brethren, are not in darkness that they should overtake you as a thief. He said, you don't have a fog over you. You're not spiritually blind. You're not in the darkness that it should come upon you unaware. But we have to remain awake and we have to remain ready. Verse 5, it says, you are children of the light and children of the day, and we are not of the night or of the darkness. Therefore, let us not sleep as others do, but let us watch and be sober. Now, he wasn't talking about physical sleep. Let us not sleep like others. You know, they sleep 10 hours, or they don't sleep well, or they've got a posturepedic and they've got a memory foam. No, let us not sleep. Let us not be spiritually asleep or mentally asleep where we're unaware, but let us watch and be sober. And I fear too many have grown drowsy or have fallen asleep, especially over the years. Even today in congregations across the country, we see attendance dropping to 50 to 70% of where it was pre-COVID. And I hate referring to COVID as a time period, but it's so often now it's like, okay, pre-COVID or 3 years ago when COVID began or when COVID ended, which now it's being pumped back up as it hasn't ended, it's still going. But we see in congregations where attendance is 50 to 70% of what it was in the past, and it changes who may be there each week. Sometimes it's like that even here in Los Angeles. But some need to stay at home, and we understand that. There's a purpose behind God's plan where he says, if you're sick, you stay home, you stay away from others, prevent others from getting sick. We have others who are shut in or people who cannot attend for various reasons, and that's not who I'm speaking of here when I say lack of attendance or they don't come on a regular basis. In the past, that's why the webcast was originally set up, for the shut-ins and for those who were ill. But across the country, time has shown that it's more of an attitude than it is an ailment. That people are staying home not because they can't come, but because, well, I'm tired. Or, you know, I've got a lot going and I don't need to be there every week. But we know for some that convenience of having a webcast, which was set up in most congregations during COVID, people have become too comfortable with staying at home. And for a time, that's all we had. But that time is gone and the restrictions have been removed. Now, we still provide that because we know people need the opportunity to tune in on the webcast. But here he says, let us not sleep. Let's not fall asleep. Let's not go to sleep spiritually or grow comfortable spiritually where that fog can set in and just kind of blind us to what's going on around us. Verse 7, it says, for they that sleep, sleep in the night. They that be drunken are drunken in the night. But let us who are of the day be sober, serious, serious-minded, putting on the breastplate of faith and love, and for a helmet the hope of salvation. the armaments that God says we use to fight the fiery darts of the wicked. For God has not appointed us to wrath, but to obtain salvation by our Lord Jesus Christ, who died for us, whether we are awake or whether we sleep, spiritually speaking, whether we have died or whether we are awake, that we should live together with him. Wherefore, comfort yourselves together and edify one another, even as also you do. Now, I know many times we turn to Hebrews where it talks about not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together. But here he says, don't fall asleep, but comfort yourselves together. He doesn't say comfort yourself alone. Comfort yourselves together. Edify one another. There has to be an ability to be together, to share those trials and difficulties, to help others through the trials and difficulties, edifying, comforting, and exhorting. And the Sabbath was designed for that. He said the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. Verse 12, it says, beseech you, brethren, to know them which labor among you and are over you in the Lord, and admonish you. Be aware, consider, perceive. It says, to esteem them very highly for their love, for their work's sake, and be at peace among yourselves. Now we exhort you, brethren, warn those that are unruly, comfort the feeble-minded, support the weak, and be patient toward all men. Those things are kind of hard to do if people aren't together. If you don't see them, if you don't know the trials and difficulties they're going through. But yet it tells us that we're to comfort. See that none render evil for evil unto any man, but ever follow that which is good, both among yourselves and to all men. Rejoice evermore. Pray without ceasing. So now as we go through this, we see some things that he says, this is what you should be doing. Pray without ceasing. In everything give thanks, for this is the will of God in Jesus Christ concerning you. Just as we heard in the opening message, we are to give thanks in prayer. So we pray without ceasing and we give thanks to God. We appreciate what's been given to us. Learn to appreciate what we have. Quench not the spirit. Now it says don't fall asleep, because if we fall asleep or if we grow spiritually groggy, or unable to see clearly, it is easier to not see things. It is easier to not use God's Holy Spirit. And it can be quenched. Despise not prophesying, which means teaching. Don't despise teaching. And sometimes people hear things and they're going, no, I make my own decisions now. I'm not going to let somebody else tell me what's right or wrong. Even from Scripture, I'll decide for myself. Well, have you studied the Scripture? Well, no. But that's my choice. You can't decide for yourself. So it says, don't despise teaching. It says, prove all things and hold fast to that which is good. It doesn't say accept all things, but it says prove all things. Prove is a word that is in the Greek dokimazo. It means to test. You test all things. It means to approve all things, to run it through a test whether you approve it or not. But this word prove also means to examine or to discern. So it says, discern all things and hold fast to that which is good. You discern. You make judgments based on the Word of God. So then you make choices. But you prove it. You discern it. If you haven't proved things to yourself, then we become gameful wolves. And at times there are spiritual wolves that come in the midst. And some, if you're spiritually awake and if you're using that spirit, it's easier to see. Are we discerning to spiritual wolves? Do we know how to identify spiritual wolves? Christ addresses these issues and tells us that we should know. But he says in the end time, what's going to happen at the end of the age? He says there's going to be deception. There's going to be false prophets, false Christs. How can we discern spiritual wolves? Matthew chapter 7, verse 15. What he was speaking to here with those who were his disciples at the time is something that we still can glean from. It says, beware of false prophets or religious imposters, false teachers. and they are prophesied to come. He says, "Beware of false prophets, which come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ravening wolves." Sometimes there's individuals that can appear, like I said, they almost right. They look like sheep. They act like sheep. You know, the old saying, if it looks like it, it acts like it, that's what it is. But they aren't easily recognized. Barnes Note says, "The sheep is an emblem of innocence, sincerity, and harmlessness. To come in sheep's clothing is to assume the appearance of sanctity and innocence when the heart is evil." Yet with discernment, we can see through that. You know, you say, well, how can you tell? I've had people say, you can't know the heart of another individual. No, but you can judge a situation and you can judge by fruits. With discernment, we can know them. By verse 16, it says, "You shall know them by their fruits, by their actions, by their integrity, by their behavior." And again, when people say, well, integrity is not doctrinal. You shall know them by their integrity. You'll know them by their actions. You'll know that they are who they say they are. "Do men gather grapes or thorns, grapes of thorns or figs of thistles? Even so, every good tree brings forth good fruit." And sometimes, that's why I said it takes time. You have to back off and look at a situation. Is it bringing forth good fruit, or is it just, does it look like from the surface that that's good fruit? "But a corrupt tree brings forth evil fruit. A good tree cannot bring forth evil fruit, neither does a corrupt tree bring forth good fruit. Every tree that brings forth good fruit is, not good fruit, rather, is hewn down, is cast into the fire. Wherefore, by their fruits you shall know them." So God says, when things happen, and they will happen in the future, when there is more deception that comes to the church, you'll know them by their fruits. Jameson, Foss, and Brown says, "You shall know them by their fruits, not their doctrines, as many of the elders or interpreters have later come to explain it." That corresponds to the tree itself. If it were doctrines, if doctrines identified a wolf, you'd recognize it very quickly. If you go, okay, I need to look in the scripture, where does it say, okay, there's a wolf and that's a wolf. Now he says, "But the practical effect of their teaching, which is the proper fruit of the tree," Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown goes on to say, "but the point I now express is not so much the end as the means of detecting them, as is already said, it's their fruits." He said, you look at the fruits, you see what can be evidenced by their actions. He goes on, "The hypocrisy of teachers now leads to a solemn warning against religious hypocrisy in general." Hypocrisy is something that, you know, having ran summer camps for years, the teens can say, we can see hypocrisy really quickly. When somebody is putting it on or somebody's acting, and they can see things very quickly. With discernment, one can see hypocrisy and somebody who's saying one thing and yet doing another. I have family members who have left the church decades ago because of hypocrisy. Now, we understand and we say, well, that's not the church. That was an individual or somebody who acted inappropriately or was a hypocrite. And they say, well, that was my memories of church, and that's why I won't go back. It can affect other individuals. And we know individuals have left because of the hypocrisy they saw. But we can be, with discernment, you see through the hypocrisy and you go, okay, God will deal with the situation, or I can make my own decisions and choices and use discernment on how to deal with the situation as it affects me. But it says ravenous wolves were come. And here in the Greek, the word ravenous means rapacious or greedy, grasping, especially for money, and sometimes willing to use unscrupulous means to obtain what is desired. Somebody who uses unscrupulous means to obtain what is desired, that's a lack of integrity. And so we look at things and we go, if a person doesn't have integrity, they're not producing the fruits, and even if they're almost right, we can't say this is right. It allows us to use that discernment, and God says that discernment can be developed, it can be honed in on. It also means destructive and vivacious, engaging in violent pillaging, or likely to harm and destroy things. And when Christ was talking about the wolves, he said, they come in and they look like they're innocent. They look like they're a part of everything. They look like everyone else. But when wolves come, they come, he says, with an evil intent. So we got through point one. I will finish this when I come back from Dallas. I do want to go through the remaining points that I have on the tools that can be used to help us through difficult times and difficult situations, especially the ones that are coming. So I plan to return that or finish that when I return. I hope you have a wonderful Thanksgiving, and I look forward to the opportunity to fellowship after services and enjoy the time and the potluck together.